Morning.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is John Fornachari. I'm from Baker Hostetler, and I represent Petra International Banking Corporation. Your Honors, the facts of this case, the substantive facts of this case are fairly simple. Mr. Farooqui owned and controlled some companies called Aegis that borrowed $10 million. He guaranteed it and then didn't pay it when they failed. But the procedural aspects of this case are just a nightmare. They are extremely...
I think we all agree.
The facts relating to the statute of limitations issue are extremely complicated, protracted, and they're just in and of themselves extremely detailed. So we think that the trial court made prejudicial error in the way it handled the granting of summary judgment in this case on count one of Mr. Farooqui's amended complaint. And we think that prejudicial error infected his decision on the motion to dismiss under 12b-6 of our amended counterclaim. And the reason I say that is there was no motion pending, no 12b-6 motion pending on either counts one or two of Mr. Farooqui's amended complaint. So there was nothing to convert under Rule 12b of the civil rules. On the other hand, if the court was really going to exercise its authority to grant summary judgment sua sponte, it gave us none of the protections that Rule 56F requires. There was no notice to us. We didn't have an opportunity to supplement the record. Your Honors, please be aware that although this case was pending for 2 years, it went through three separate judges. It went through Judge Leon, Judge Kennedy, and ended with Judge Lambert. And during that time, the only deposition discovery that was taken was jurisdictional. There was an order limiting discovery in general. So when the order was entered, there was no oral argument. When the order was entered, granting the 12b-6 motion dismissing the amended counterclaim on statute of limitations grounds and granting summary judgment on count one of the amended complaint, there was even no room for my client, PIBC, to request leave to amend because summary judgment had been granted. In this case, we had never sought leave to amend the counterclaim.
Suppose it
was
the case that the district court's ruling on whether the document was sealed or not is correct. Does that leave any room for these arguments?
I think it does, Your Honor, because if we had an opportunity to put evidence before the court, we would have put into the record several 11, to be exact, amendments to the note that went through 1993, and it was a demand note for a sum certain, which means that the statute...
1993 doesn't help, does it?
No, but... It help you on the sealing issue.
Well, because it would have triggered... Because they were now a demand note for a sum certain, mm-hmm. It would have implicated a different statute of limitations. There's a statute of limitations that is 28.3118 for demand notes for sum certains, that is 10 years. Plus, after 6 years, if notice is given of a demand after 6 years of within the last payment, we have a certain amount of time, another 6 years to sue. So if we had the opportunity to put this information before the court, this evidence before the court, it would have changed the entire character of the case.
This is not an argument that you raised in the district court, right?
No, because We had no notice that he was going to enter summary judgment, so we never put, we notice pled, Your Honor, and we, in our notice pleading, we said that we entered an arrangement with the company that defaulted to work out the loan, which we worked out through the end of 1997 going into 1998, okay? And so we thought that was a good pleading to get us to 1998 and into the ceiling statute, all right?
So you're saying that one possible outcome here would be that we might affirm the decision of the district court as to the original document not being sealed, but remand to the district court for it to allow leave to amend the complaint.
That's one outcome, Your Honor. Or remand it, reverse because of the way the Rule 56 motion was entered.
That was embedded in what.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because it really infected our ability to seek leave to amend the complaint. If he just ruled on the 12B6 motion, we would have sought leave to amend the complaint. Having never had the opportunity to amend before, I'm sure it would have been given to us, and we would have pled all this because we would have known what his problem was, what the judge's problem was. So if we had the notice that was required under Rule 56, this whole case would be different. The evidence would be different. I mean, there were 11, Your Honor, the way the case stands now, forget about the ceiling for a minute, but just on the statute of limitations, the way the case stands now, the statute of limitations ran on the post-petition lending before it was made.
But let me ask you this. The response is that you knew that the statute of limitations was a key threshold issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that there were multiple briefings in this case where essentially these points could have been made. So that this is not where the district court sort of came up with an idea of its own and said, oh, I'll grant summary judgment. This was a matter that had obviously been pending for some time. And the key issue was on the table.
I think Judge Rogers, I agree there was briefing, but there was briefing on a 12B6 issue and on jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. The idea that he was going to make this a summary judgment motion, which would have cut off all our rights, was never on the table. And in fact, if we had notice of it, as the rule required, we would have admitted or put in front of him what we believe was the relevant evidence to trigger the statute 28.3.118 and to show that this entire controversy had an entire history that went well into 1998 and, in fact, resumed again in 2002 and 2003 as is pled in the amended complaint of Mr. Faruqi. So this isn't a case that just a loan that lay dormant for 25 years. This loan was being worked and collected through 1997 into 1998. And then again, we were in contact with Mr. Faruqi as he pleads in his complaint in 2002. So this is not what the facts of this case really confirms is the admonition that district courts have gotten several times about ruling on affirmative defenses on 12B6 motions. There's no record in front of it. We didn't even know he was considering a summary judgment motion because we never got the notice required by Rule 56F. And so we had no opportunity, A, to ask to take some depositions, which we would have asked, or B, putting in the entire record of the loan, which we had with Aegis, the borrower in this case, that had numerous amendments to it. And so we really had no opportunity in this case to make a record that this claim is well within the statute of limitations, the relevant statutes of limitations. Our position has always been that it's been in the statute, and there's two or three statutes that could apply. So we would think that the one way to remedy this is to reverse and remand and either allow us to replead or make them make their motion for summary judgment and give us an opportunity to reply to a motion for summary judgment, which we never had. My time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Gray Stratton for Appellee Ehuda Faruqi. Your Honor, this is not a complicated case. This is an old dispute, true, but this notion that a different statute of limitations applies than we've been litigating in this case for the past 4 years is it's surprising and it's wrong. Appellants.
But it is the case, isn't it, that there's a general presumption in favor of a right to an opportunity to amend a complaint, right?
And that is true, Your Honor, and appellants have amended their complaint in this case. That is correct, not necessarily in response to, no, I take that back. I believe they did amend their complaint or their counterclaim in response to the motions to dismiss in this case. There certainly was an amended counterclaim filed.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, whatever procedural error appellants are arguing for in this case, or arguing the court to take notice of, is harmless, and harmless error is the standard of review in terms of procedural error in the entry of a sua sponte summary judgment order.
You think it was an error?
Your Honor, appellee would concede that the reference to 12D was likely in error, but the district court below cited its authority under 12D to enter summary judgment and its authority under Celotex and this court's other decisions to enter summary judgment sua sponte, and that, Your Honor, was...
Isn't there supposed to be notice and a time to respond?
Your Honor, the district court held that there was, in this case, an opportunity to respond and notice based on the fact that we had been litigating statute of limitations for 4 years in the district court.
Don't you think the notice in 56F probably refers to notice not of the issue being part of the case, but notice that the court is contemplating summary judgment? Seems the more likely reading of that rule.
Agreed, Your Honor, which is why I return to the standard of review being harmless error, because these were legal conclusions made by the district court in support of its entry of summary judgment, and no amount of facts that appellant has argued it would like the opportunity to submit or would have liked the opportunity to submit to the district court would have altered those legal conclusions in any way. And I'd like to get us back onto what I think are the really pertinent issues for this review, which are whether this is a contract under seal, which was what was before the district court, and when did the cause of action against Mr. Faruqi accrue. And as I said, this is an old dispute. The contract of guarantee at issue in this case and the loan were entered in 1986, over 25 years ago. By 1987, the borrower was bankrupt and in default. By 1993, the borrower was in liquidation and in complete and incurable default. And by that, I mean the borrower was no longer making any payments on the loan and no longer had any ability to make payments on the loan from that point.
Let me just be clear. At that point, and I was trying to trace this in the record, the loan was for what, $3.5 million?
Approximately, Your Honor, $3.7 million.
3.7. Then...
Sorry, what date?
The date of the liquidation was 1993. The date of the bankruptcy was 1987.
The date as of which the loans were 3. Whatever.
In other words...
The 80s, right?
Yes.
That was the maximum amount for the secured facility, the secured lending facility, which was a revolving credit facility, which is why, despite appellant's argument, this is not a negotiable instrument. This is not commercial paper. There was no fixed
amount.
What I'm
trying to understand is the course of dealings. In other words, there was an initial loan for this 3.7. The company went bankrupt. And then I gather from somewhere in the record that the decision was made by the bank. It was not in its interest not to lend additional money so the company could get back on its feet. So there were these additional loans made.
That's correct, Your Honor. And those additional loans were made during the period of Aegis's bankruptcy between 1987 and 1993. Appellants have never argued that the additional loan amounts or any modifications extended beyond Aegis's liquidation in 93, after which it was a defunct company. And there is no argument that appellants have made and no authority they have cited to suggest that the statute of limitations should have been delayed from after Aegis's liquidation in 93 to 1997.
Oh, no money was loaned after 93.
That is correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. And the only justification that PIBC has ever offered that the statute of limitations should have been delayed until 1997 was its pursuit of collateral security underlying the loan. And there is no authority to support the delay of the statute of limitations during that period, particularly when the guarantee at issue at paragraph 6, record A175, states that the guarantors waive any right to require lender to proceed against or exhaust any security held from the borrower. There was no requirement that PIBC exhaust its other collection efforts before pursuing its cause of action against Mr. Faruqi. As a result, during that period of time when PIBC was collecting collateral on this loan, it had a viable cause of action against Mr. Faruqi to the extent it ever did, and the statute of limitations was running.
So even in the most generous statute of limitations possible here, which I think is 12 years, still doesn't work.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Under your theory.
Appellants have to prove both that this was a contract under seal, which it is not, under clear.
But even assuming we disagree with you on that, just assume arguendo, that still gets you to a 12-year, right?
That's right.
If the 12-year is not good enough, you're saying, because it goes back 93, it started running, and the suit wasn't filed to 09.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. Even assuming that the modifications to the underlying loan had the effect of modifying the guarantor's obligation, which we dispute based on paragraph 4 of the guarantee, even if those modifications to the underlying loan modified the guarantor's obligation, there is no authority to support delaying the running of the statute of limitations to 1997, particularly in light of that paragraph 6.
Under that theory, it potentially could go to 93, but not to 97. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Under the most generous reading of appellant's pleadings, those modifications could have extended to 1993, but they've never argued any basis for extending to 1997 other than its collection of collateral. And that's what they rely on in their amended counterclaim at paragraph 27 and 28. And on this question of seal, Your Honor, the D.C. Court of Appeals decision in Murray versus Wells Fargo is directly on point here. The parties agree that this is the controlling authority. And on the strength of the Murray case alone, this court can and should affirm the district court's decision in this case. The case is on all fours with ours. In Murray, as in this case, there was an alleged contract under seal. There was a notary stamp affixed to the contract, and there was an alleged recitation of the party's intent to seal the contract. In Murray, however, I would note that the alleged intent to seal was even more conspicuous and it was a stronger statement of intent than is present in Mr. Faruqi's guarantee. In the Murray case, immediately above the signature lines, the contract bore an attestation clause which read, "In witness hereof, the parties hereunto set their official hand and seal." Underneath that attestation clause was the party's signature. Underneath the party's signature was the notary stamp. With all of those elements, the highest court of the District of Columbia nevertheless held that this was not an instrument under seal. Our case is exactly the same. Appellants have argued to escape the weight of the authority in the Murray case. They've done so unsuccessfully. They've argued that the intent of the parties is what's controlling under Murray. That is not the holding of the Murray case. The Murray case was absolutely clear when it said the operative fact is the presence or absence of an actual seal. And here, we do not have an actual seal affixed or adopted.
Also, that talks about intent that the document be sealed.
You're correct, Your Honor.
McMurray is two-faced.
You're correct. It does discuss the intent of the parties, but the intent of the parties is not considered the operative fact. The operative fact is the presence or absence of a seal affixed or adopted. The statement relating to the intent of the parties quoted by appellants is a parenthetical of a District of Maryland decision. And I don't mean to suggest that intent of the parties is not relevant. It is relevant, but a statement of intent is not enough. That was proven in Murray when there was an attestation clause reflecting the party's intent to seal the document. But because the signatories did not actually affix or adopt a seal, the document was nevertheless not under seal. And let's talk about the party's intent in this case, Your Honor, because that's a very important point. The key provision that appellants rely upon in support of Mr. Faruqi having an intent to seal this instrument is a recital clause on page 1 of the guarantee, which isn't a statement of Mr. Faruqi's intent at all. It's a statement of the lender's intent with respect to the loan. It states, lender has agreed to make the loan upon the express condition that this guarantee agreement be executed, sealed, and delivered by guarantors.
It's framed in terms of the guarantors. The lender's intent, but it's pretty clear that it won't work without, in terms of satisfying the lender's intent, unless the guarantor goes along with it, right? And the guarantor signs the document.
That's true, Your Honor, but
accept this condition.
It's not the lender's intent that is relevant here. It's the signatory's intent. This recital is a perfect example of what Williston and the Restatement of Contracts warn about recitals of sealing. They are often incorrect. This is inconsistent with the remainder of the guarantee, and it's inconsistent with the loan documents itself.
As far as we're looking at intent, it seems to me that the one party's making clear that that party is in on the deal only under a particular circumstance, and the other party's signing it suggests the other party accepts this as part of the deal, right? And that would seem to me to satisfy the intent requirement.
I disagree, Your Honor, because this, first of all, is a formulaic recital. Second of all, this is
a... How is it formulaic? I don't understand that.
A contract will be signed, sealed, and delivered. To most negotiating parties today, I doubt those words would even bear meaning. When you compare it to the conditions of lending in the loan document...
A lot of people seeing the word seal written next to something would not think it had any meaning.
What I think would bear more meaning, Your Honor, is if a party actually affixed their own seal, which is what the D.C. Court of Appeals is looking for. An actual adoption or affixing of their seal. And this is important. I really want to draw the court's attention to comparing that recital language to the actual conditions of lending in the secured promissory facility, which is at A149. The document in conditions of lending, section 6.02, does not reference that a condition of lending is that this guarantee agreement would be sealed. Rather, at 6.02b, the condition of lending states only that a guarantee in substantially the form attached hereto will be executed by Ehuda Faruqi and Ali T. Faruqi. No reference of sealing this document. Compare again the recital in the guarantee, the forward-looking statement of condition, to the actual representation of the guarantors in paragraph 5. Of the guarantee on record A175. Paragraph 5 states not that the guarantors had sealed this document, but rather guarantors further represent and warrant that the guarantee has been executed and delivered, not that it had been sealed. Again, this is precisely what the Restatement of Contracts in Williston warned. Recitals of sealing are often incorrect.
But again, all of this, even if we disagree with you completely on the sealing issue, or we don't need to even reach that, right, if, assuming 12 years and 1993 is the last date, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There
it depends on whether we agree with you on that, I realize. But if we were to do that, we don't have to get into the ceiling issue. Correct?
That's right, Your Honor. Appellants have to win both arguments, that one, this is not a contract under seal, which it is under the clear authority of Murray. They also have to convince the court that the statute of limitations was told or in not accruing until 1997, for which they've offered no authority and no factual support.
Well, I just want to be clear about on summary judgment. Suppose that there was a memorandum somewhere that stated that Mr. Faruqi was agreeing to toll the statute of limitations and have further dealings with the bank. I mean, just hypothetically, suppose there was such a document in the record. We don't know that. The district court didn't know that. And the argument is that the bank never had the opportunity to put that document into the record because it had no notice that the district court was about to enter summary judgment.
Your Honor, respectfully, If appellants were to make that argument, and that does sound very similar to the argument that the appellants are making, that argument is all form and no substance. We've been litigating statute of limitations for 4 years in the district court. As a dispositive issue, they had every motivation to submit any evidence that would support their statute of limitations theory, and they submitted no evidence, no factual issue that changed the conclusions of law or would change the conclusions of law rendered by the district court in this case.
And this is because all of those documents would go to the affirmative defense?
Those documents being the documents that appellants have offered or suggested they would like to offer, Your Honor, is that what you're...
In my hypothetical. In other words, they had every motivation on the 12B6 issue and the affirmative defense to put in any document about tolling, any document about further agreements, any documents about modification.
Absolutely, Your Honor, absolutely. From the first pleading in this case, statute of limitations was the defining issue of this case.
So where there is such a motivation, then the court should ignore the language in the rule saying that the notice shall be given in Rule 56.
Your Honor, I would suggest that there's no reason to look hypothetically beyond the pleadings and arguments that have been made. Appellants have never argued that there was a tolling agreement in place in this case. And if there was, to be sure, they would have made that point.
So you're not suggesting we ignore the language in the rule? You're saying that...
Don't say yes to that.
Well, I'm just trying to be clear what you are arguing is that you're saying that the course of dealings here was sufficient notice that if they didn't win on the statute of limitations issue, the case was over and judgment would be entered?
Absolutely, and that was the language in the order was that the district court felt that notice...
Yeah.
Was present on statute of limitations, and through six rounds of briefing, each party had an opportunity to say as much as needed to be said.
I took your point earlier to follow up on what I just interjected. I took your point earlier to be that obviously you should follow the rule, but either it's harmless here or under the course of how this proceeded, there was sufficient notice and opportunity to respond. So that's what I...
That's absolutely correct.
Obviously, we're not going to write an opinion that says ignore the rule in 56F.
To be sure, Your Honor, and just to follow up on your point.
I'm just kidding. There are many ways to write that clause.
Yes,
all right.
I agree.
So, anyway.
In these rounds of briefing, was that within the rounds of briefing within the parameters of the complaint, or were parties shoveling in new evidence?
Parties were submitting additional documentary evidence in connection with those 12B6 motions, and that came from both appellants and appellees.
Anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for appellant.
I don't know where to start because there were a lot of mistakes made in that. First of all, on the amended complaint, Judge Williams, plaintiffs filed an amended complaint in this case that's changed drastically, which forced us to file an amended counterclaim to meet an answer and allegations in the complaint. We never...
You weren't, are you, disputing counsel's contention just a few seconds ago that in the course of these rounds, both parties submitted documents, and I say background documents, not just the briefs, which at least presumably would color the situation of the impact of shifting from a motion to dismiss to a summary judgment.
I am, Your Honor. And the way I'm disputing it is this way. There were motions pending on jurisdiction. We certainly entered and put things in the record on jurisdiction. On the 12B6 motion, the only attachments to the 12B6 motion came from plaintiff, and they were documents that were referred to in the counterclaim, which was the credit facility, the original guarantee, and documents that were referred to, I believe, all in the original counterclaim. We didn't respond with any documents on that. We treated it as a 12B6 motion because we had pled in our complaint that the course of dealings between these parties on this loan went through 1997. In the record, at page 188, is a power of attorney signed by Mr. Faruqi as president of Aegis, giving the bank authority to prosecute a claim on behalf of Aegis in collecting the loan. So we were collecting on this loan for Aegis through 1997 going into 1998.
Well, that's a different question, right, isn't it, than extending the loan agreement or altering the loan agreement? I mean, just because you're collecting on it.
Your Honor, but that's where Rawlinson comes in. We weren't collecting on it simply because it was collateral. We're collecting on it because we had an arrangement with the lender, which under Rawlinson told a statute of limitations because the guarantee, and we quoted the guarantee in our amended counterclaim, specifically gave us the authority to make an arrangement with the borrower to extend the loan and without affecting the liability of the guarantor. So, Your Honor, all of this information would have been before the court in addition to the 11 amendments to the note.
What was the extension of the loan here? I mean, there was
a demand. The loan was, he filed for bankruptcy in 1987 for reorganization. Mm-hmm. He wanted us, the bank, to continue lending him money. We said we'd continue lending him money, and every time we lent him money, we amended the note and we amended the credit facilities. Mm-hmm. There were 11 amendments to the note and 11 amendments to the credit facility, all under, covered by the guarantee. And this happened through 1990. The last amendment, which is not in the record because we didn't have a chance to put it in, is a demand note for $10.5 million, which triggers this statute, 28.3.118, that we never cited before the district court because we never had notice that he was going to entertain summary judgment. And if he had ruled on the 12B6 motion, Your Honor.
It wasn't cited in your opening brief here either, was it?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor, but we followed the rule and submitted it as supplemental authority more than a week ago.
Right, I saw that, but I was curious why it wasn't in the opening brief.
Because I didn't realize we were going to get this deeply into this argument, to tell you the truth, and I didn't realize I'd be talking about 11 amendments and the last note being a demand note for a sum certain. But that's all I'm asking is that the case be remanded to give us the notice we're entitled and let us have an opportunity to amend. If he's right, it'll get dismissed, and we won't be back, and it'll be affirmed, and the rule will be followed.
Have you said anything that gets us beyond
1993? Yes, Your Honor.
Apart from collection efforts.
The collection efforts were part of an agreement that Rawlinson says extended the statute.
And the agreement is dated what?
The agreement is dated in 1990 when we started making post-petition loans to them. So, Your Honor, this power of attorney at 180A188 is totally inconsistent with any idea that this loan was just sitting there and that Faruqi, as president of Aegis, had nothing to do with it. I mean, the document starts out, A. Huda Faruqi being at all pertinent times the president and authorized corporate representative of American Export Group International Services, Aegis, right, is now authorizing us on his behalf, on Aegis's behalf, to collect claims. The reason this is so confusing is there is no full record here, which there would have been if we had the appropriate notice and an opportunity to put the evidence in the record.
I might have missed your answer to Judge Williams. Did you cite anything that's gotten us beyond 1993 that's extending the loan agreement? Is that what you were pointing to here on 180?
Was it anything that gets us beyond 1993?
You have to get to 1997, I think, even under the most generous statute of limitations.
Under the...
Right?
No. What the complaint alleges is that we've collected money we and in this arrangement with him, we're exercising our right to collect money under the loan on behalf of Aegis and reducing its debt through at least 1997. In fact, the collections on this suit itself went through 1998. So whether it's under seal, Your Honor, which is 12 years, or it's under 28.3.118B, because there was a demand note, the last note in 1990 was a demand note for some certain that I admit is not in the record because we had no opportunity to put it there, would have triggered a statute that says from the date of the last payment, which was in 1998, we have 6 years to make a demand for full payment on the note. If we make a demand within the 6 years, we have 10 years in which to bring suit. He admits in the amended complaint that 1997 we tried to collect this here, which is well within the 10 years, okay? And he also admits there was a demand made on him. He admits that we were talking to him in 2003 and 2004 in an amended complaint. So under the most generous statute of limitations...
Collection efforts don't extend the statute of limitations.
But, Your Honor, we were collecting with Aegis, with the borrower. So under Rawlinson, right, if we have...
Rawlinson was extending the agreement, right?
Under Rawlinson...
Not just collection efforts. Am I right? Correct me if I'm wrong. That's how I...
No, I think, to be accurate, Rawlinson says if we have an agreement with the original borrower that is authorized in the guarantee, the statute is told for as long as the arrangement between us and the borrower, the original borrower, lasts. Our arrangement with Faruqi, which the power of attorney I cited to you is some evidence, was that we would collect all the loans of Aegis, credit it to Aegis, and also pay Faruqi a share of that. And the fact that he is writing under oath an affidavit in 1998 saying he's assigning us not collateral, but he's assigning us a claim on behalf of Aegis is an indication that we were making these collections on behalf of Aegis, and to the extent funds were collected, they were being credited to Aegis's debt.
I'm sorry, and this assignment is in
I think it's 188, Your Honor.
Just a minor point. You would make the table of contents of the appendix much clearer if you, instead of saying exhibits A through I of such or you said what the exhibits actually had to do with.
I agree, Your Honor. I apologize. So it's page one, it's A188. It's entitled Power of Attorney. And it starts off with A. Huda Faruqi being, at all pertinent times, the president and authorized corporate representative of American Export Group International Services. And it goes on. And it doesn't say he's assigning us collateral. He says he's assigning us a claim on behalf of Aegis. Your Honors, I mean, in all seriousness here, if we had notice that we were going to have a summary judgment proceeding in front of the court, we would have had a full record, you would have had a full record, and I would have been more confident in the way I'm arguing this motion. But the fact of the matter is, the court below committed error in the way it handled the procedural aspects of this case, and that tainted the whole thing.
All right. Thank you. We have your argument. We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.